As we celebrate President's Day, learn what our founding fathers really believed. Next on Gospel of Life. Hello, I'm Reverend Frank Pavone, Director of Gospel of Life Ministries. Welcome to our program. We're joined by Janet Marana, our Associate Director, and by David Barton, the President and Founder of Wall Builders. Thank you both for being here.
Good to be here.
I read your book, Original Intent, and have been promoting it across the country because I think it's one of the best analyses of the relationship between the courts, the Constitution, and religion. And it is clear to me, having read this book, that our students in our school systems, when they study American history, are not getting the straight story.
Yeah.
They are getting a distorted,
right,
a truncated version, in some cases a totally false version, of what our founding fathers believed, mm-hmm, what they were intending to do, and of who they were.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the message of Original Intent.
Message of Original Intent goes back to original documents and writings. We've got a bunch here we're going to share, but I mean, there are things here that's 240 years old by one of the founding fathers. So we're not talking about something that a professor somewhere wrote, something that some intellectual wrote. We're talking about the actual works and documents, and that's the best way to know original intent, is to go back and see what the guys themselves actually said. I've been involved in a number of Supreme Court cases, and I get called in to provide historical perspective on the case. And I remember one of the cases we were involved with, one of the Supreme Court justices made a very ill-advised statement. Unfortunately, they do that way too often anyway. But this particular ill-advised statement, he said, 200 years ago, that's a long time. We can't be sure what our founding fathers wanted 200 years ago. And such a silly statement. They did on paper what we do with cameras and tapes and VCRs. They wrote it all down. That's why George Washington has 97 volumes of personal writings. 200,000 letters the guy wrote and kept copies of all of them. Jefferson's got 60 volumes and Hamilton's got 40 and Franklin's got 40 and Adams has got 33. And these guys wrote it all down. So Original Intent says, we're told today that this is what they want, but here's what they really said. An example I like to use is this little book right here. I speak in law schools and universities across the nation, and this is a very widely used textbook now. It's called The Godless Constitution. And it's real simple. We are a great nation because we've been secular from the beginning. Our Constitution is godless. And, of course, we know the guys that wrote our Constitution were godless. They were atheists, agnostics, deists. Secular people gave us a godless Constitution, and that's why we've been blessed for 200 years. That's current stuff. You go back into the old stuff, and you find that's not true. The guys who gave us our Declaration, our Constitution, the Declaration, great example, 56 guys gave us our national birth certificate. 24 of the 56 signers of the Declaration held either seminary or Bible school degrees. Now, somehow there's supposed to be a bunch of godless guys, and that doesn't hold water. This book that I mentioned earlier that's 200 and some odd years old, this is done in 1767, and it's done by a signer of the Declaration, Francis Hopkinson. And Francis Hopkinson was a federal judge. He was also the man who designed the American flag, so a real distinguished founding father. But he's also a minister that was a church music director and a choir leader. So what this book is this is the entire book of Psalms set to music. And he did that so that they could sing the Psalms 300 years ago like David has sung them 2,000 years ago now, or 4,000 years ago in the case of David. But, I mean, thinking about an atheist sitting the entire book of Psalms to music, I mean, that doesn't happen. But what happens today is, who's ever heard of Francis Hopkinson? You know, nobody knows that guy. We talk about the signers of the Declaration, and what immediately comes to mind is Jefferson and Franklin. And that's where it stops. We've been trained to recognize the two least religious, and we don't know the others. We can't talk about Francis Hopkinson. We can't talk about Benjamin Rush, or we can't talk about Robert Morris or Elbridge Gerry or Benjamin Harrison or Thomas McKean, or George Reed, or Robert Livingston, or Roger Sherman, or all these other names. We know two. And we think that Jefferson and Franklin aren't very religious. And for that generation, they would have been the least religious founders. But I guarantee I don't know any Christians today who are willing to go as far as Jefferson and Franklin went with Christian faith.
Yeah. Tell us some examples of what they did.
You know, a great example is Thomas Jefferson when he was president. Nobody disputes the fact that he's one of the least religious founding fathers. I agree with that. But when he's president, 1801 to 1809, he's president. 1801, the Capitol was a brand new building in 1801. And so in 1801, when the founding fathers moved in, they moved in December of 1800. And so 1801, Jefferson's president. When they moved into the Capitol building in December of 1800, according to the records of Congress, the founding fathers voted that the Capitol building itself would serve simultaneously as a church building. So every Sunday, the Capitol building became a church building. And by the way, by 1867, it was the largest church in America. Over 2,000 people a week went to church at the Capitol. But 1801, guess where Thomas Jefferson goes to church? Twice on Sunday to the Capitol. That's his church home. Well, I don't know most Christians who'd be comfortable having a church in a government building and going to it. But Jefferson didn't stop there. It was a brand new church. He's trying to get his feet on the ground. He's commander-in-chief. He goes back and orders the Marine Corps band to go play worship services at the Capitol building. So Jefferson does that. And then Jefferson, it takes him to get from where he lived to the Capitol. It took him about 40 minutes either walking or on horseback. And to do that twice on Sunday, you're looking at 3 hours travel time. So Jefferson says, I'm president. I'm the executive officer. I have the executive department. I have two buildings here. I have the Treasury Department and the War Department, both executive office buildings. He started church services in both of those buildings on Sunday. So you could go in church D.C., you could go to the Capitol building or the Treasury building or the Capitol building. You know, who thinks about that? And then in 1803, 2 years later, he negotiated a treaty with the Kaskaskia Indians. And in that treaty, Jefferson inserted federal funds to pay for missionaries to go evangelize the Indians. And then he inserted a clause so that with those federal funds, after you evangelize the Indians, you would build them places in which to worship, houses of worship. Now, I don't know of a Christian today who thinks the federal government ought to spend money to evangelize people or that the federal government should build churches for people. But Jefferson did, and he's the least religious founding father. And then in 1804, I have this document from Thomas Jefferson, signed by the president, Thomas Jefferson, and he signs it in the year of our Lord Christ. Now, what would happen if presidents today were to start signing their presidential documents in the year of our Lord Christ?
Supreme Court cases. Yeah, you
know, all over the place. That's right. But Thomas Jefferson did it. And so we're told the original intent says that we shouldn't be having faith in the public arena. No. Even your least... Franklin, on the other hand, he's the other least religious founding father. It's because of Franklin that we have paid chaplains in the House and Senate to pray every day. I mean, that's the reason that we have Father Daniel Coughlin as the House chaplain and that we had Lloyd Ogilvie and now Barry Black as our Senate chaplain. And they get paid to pray. That's because of Ben Franklin, our least religious founding father. Mm-hmm. So you just can't argue that these guys were not strong in their faith, that the overwhelming majority were Christians. Out of the 250 folks we call founding fathers, there's maybe a dozen that we would say would be anti-faith, which, you know, you're running about 4 or 5%. As far as non-Christians, it's hard to find any of them except those dozen that are not Christians. Mm-hmm. It's strong stuff. History's really clear on this stuff.
Well, you know, Dave, we're about to inaugurate a president, and of course, once again, people will say that there's no religion there, that, you know, and I'm sure the ceremony itself must date back, and maybe you could give us the history and show us some religious significance in that ceremony.
There is, and it's interesting, that first inauguration took place with George Washington. I have here a letter that George Washington wrote in 1783. And this famous letter of Washington, his last official address to the legislatures of the United States, this has his prayer for America in this. And in this letter that he wrote, he puts out the prayer that he's, and he points out, we've just won the revolution. What a great time. We're happy about that. But he says, if we don't have a humble imitation of the divine author of our blessed religion, Jesus Christ, we can never hope to be a happy nation. Mm-hmm. So he starts off by saying, guys, we've won the war. That won't make us happy. What will make us happy is imitating Christ. Now, that's Washington. So here this man becomes our first president. So it becomes time for him to be sworn in as first president. And as he's being sworn in, the Constitution requires an oath of office. But Washington did several things that were a little different then. Number one, he's got a Bible. He wanted to swear in on a Bible. So he takes his oath on a Bible, upraised hand. He takes the oath of the Constitution, and then he adds a line that says, so help me God. Washington is the guy who added that.
He adds it.
He adds that. That's not in the constitutional requirement. He adds that, and every president since then has done that. And then after he was sworn in on that Bible, said, "So help me God," he leaned over and kissed the Bible to show his reverence and veneration for that book. And that was that official first inauguration. And the next thing they did was he and all the members of Congress went across the street to a church service and had a church service to commemorate that swearing in as the president. So it's a very religious service from top to bottom that George Washington did in that first inaugural address. We've had a few others like that that have been very striking, very powerful. Usually presidents nowadays will have a minister give an invocation and a benediction. When Eisenhower was sworn in 1952, and Eisenhower, God literally did some miraculous things in his life. When he was 13 years old, he should have had his leg amputated. He has an infection. The doctor wanted to amputate it, and he made his mother stand outside the door and keep the doctor out for days on end while they were praying for his leg, and his leg actually became healed, and he was fine. And had he lost that leg, he wouldn't be the commander-in-chief of forces during World War II, and he wouldn't have done D-Day, and we would have had a different guy. So real providential the way it worked out. So when it comes time to have his inauguration as president, he doesn't mess with getting the minister to offer prayers. He says, "Everyone pray with me." And so he just bowed his head. He led the whole inaugural activity in prayer there from the Capitol looking across the mall. So it's really cool to see how many presidents we've had that have been strong in their faith. I actually have a letter here from President James A. Garfield.
Now, these are original documents.
These are original
documents.
Let's
point out to our viewers. Yes, this is actual stuff here.
This is from 1858.
Right. And
this is James A. Garfield down here in the corner. President James A. Garfield, and he has just finished preaching a revival service where he preached the gospel of Jesus Christ 19 times in that meeting. You know, we don't think a president's doing stuff like that today.
Right.
But you go back to Washington and look at traditions we've had since then. One of the other presidents I have a lot of fun with is John Quincy Adams. And John Quincy Adams, president of the United States, actually did this little book. This was done for 10-year-olds to show 10-year-olds how to read through the Bible once every year. Now, here's the President of the United States encouraging people to read the Word of God, stay in the Word of God. You know, just phenomenal stuff that we had back then. So as we come to that inauguration, there is great history there of presidents and how faith has been involved and the stuff of making it secular and the stuff of guys saying, "Oh, it's a godless constitution." It just does not hold water historically.
Well, this book is one of the greatest ways that people can have in their hands some of the best quotes. You mentioned dozens and dozens of volumes that our founders wrote, but you took some of the most powerful quotes illustrating what you've just said and put them into this book, which is very helpful. What I found fascinating here is that you also trace how the Supreme Court, decisions, especially over the last 60 years or so, has redefined the term religion.
Yes.
And has misapplied the so-called separation of church and state, which is a phrase nowhere to be found in the Constitution. Give us a quick summary of what you present on that.
Yeah, and it's key because what you've said about separation not being there is a shock to most people. We've seen national polls where that literally 67% of the nation thought that the phrase separation of church and state was in the Constitution. And it's not. It didn't appear. The records of that whole framing of the First Amendment cover 6 months. We had 90 founding fathers work on the First Amendment for 6 months. It went from June the 7th through September the 25th of 1789. Not a single one of the 90 ever even mentioned the phrase separation of church and state. So the guys who gave us that didn't even talk about it. Now, what they said was, they said, "We don't want in America what we had in Great Britain. We don't want the federal government making us all one denomination of Christians. We don't all want to be Catholics or Presbyterians or Anglicans or Baptists or Methodists." And they went through all these denominations. I mean, we had a ton of denominations in America. And they said, "That's what the First Amendment's about. We don't want the federal government telling us what church you have to go to." Now, if we want to call that separation of church and state, let's go for it, because that was their idea. And that's why it says, the First Amendment says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the exercise thereof." Congress can't pass a law that says you have to belong to this church. Can't do it. Yeah, I mean, Congress, and that's great, and we love it. And that's their separation, church and state.
Mm-hmm.
But where we've gone today is say, "Oh, you can't have the Ten Commandments where someone might see that in public. That violates that." That's not it at all.
That's absurd.
See,
right.
What the court has done is the founding fathers, James Madison especially, August 15, 1789, talked about the purpose of the First Amendment is to prevent the establishment of a federal denomination. The courts have now defined religion to no longer mean denomination, but to mean a religious activity. So instead of meaning an established denomination, It now means saying a prayer at a football game.
So religion ends up meaning, a worldview. I mean, if I profess to be an atheist,
yes,
then that becomes my religion.
That's right.
In the thinking of the court.
That's right.
And instead of, as our founding fathers acknowledged, the state has a duty to acknowledge its dependence on God, which they did in the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And the way in which you carry out that worship, that's another question.
That's right.
Free to be what denomination
you want.
That
was the right of conscience. The government is going to protect the acknowledgement of God. The government is going to protect. The government was not for secular society. As a matter of fact, this little document is from 1796. That is George Washington's final address, his farewell address. And in this, he reminds us of our political prosperity. And what he tells us in here, he said, of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, he said, religion and morality are indispensable supports. If you want your politics to prosper, the two things you don't separate are religion and morality. Now we're doing exactly that. You know, we want our politics to prosper. Well, we can't let the church tell us what marriage means, and we can't let somebody mention God, and we can't have under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Exactly the opposite, and you're exactly right. This thing of religion now means whatever you believe. And in 1977, the court in a case, Thurial Silber, said religion is whatever you believe so ardently that it affects the way you behave. Well, if that's religion, then atheism is a religion. You know, the belief in no God is the belief in a religion. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, then that means you can't separate religion from government, because somebody's belief is going to affect the way they behave. And if that is their religion, it will be involved in government. You know, you could say partisanship is a religion, because that affects the way people behave. Under that core definition, that's a religion. If we want separation of church and state, then let's keep politics out of government. You can't do it. I mean, what they've done is create something that is absolutely impossible. But what it does is it keeps basically God-fearing, moral, Judeo-Christian ethics out, lets everything else in and keeps that out.
Before we go on to more about this book, this can be obtained through your organization, Wall Builders, right? How would people go about getting the book?
If they go to our website, wallbuilders.com, and just click on the store, it's right there. And you guys also have it as well. And can go to your site and get it there as well.
That's right. And gospelalife.com. And we've been very happy to promote it. One of the things you do here, of course, is you trace some pivotal Supreme Court decisions that have shown and that continue to show how we are at the risk of losing our self-governance because the courts are imposing policies upon the American people that we never voted for and that we don't support, such as removing prayer from schools, and as you already mentioned, viewing of the Ten Commandments, Bible reading in schools, and then, of course, abortion and even partial birth abortion, and now the redefinition of marriage. Very, very helpful resources in this book for people to understand what the proper role of the courts is in the vision of our founders.
And it's not policymaking. I mean, absolutely not. The Founding Fathers and the Federalist Papers talked about all three branches, what they're to do. And it's interesting. They said the judiciary is the least dangerous of all the branches, and the liberty of the people will never be endangered from the judiciary. Because the way they had written it, judiciary was going to stay a really small branch. We've gone today to where that we say we have three co-equal branches. Founding Fathers said we have three co-sovereign branches. They're not equal. They said legislative is number one, executive is number two, and the weakest of all is judiciary because it's not elected, so it can't make policy. Now, these others can make policy because they've been elected by the people. I mean, their clear intent is really clear. The Constitution is explicitly clear because they knew what they wanted to do, and they told us, and the Constitution tells us what they wanted. But we just don't much study that document anymore today, and so the courts are now acting like they're never supposed to.
You know, David, it reminds me of if you take a tour of the Capitol building, their intent is really played out in the architecture of the Capitol. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, the architecture of the Capitol, when the founders designed that building and started building it, they would not let the Supreme Court have a separate building. They kept the Supreme Court inside the U.S. Capitol building so they could keep an eye on those guys. And so it was not until, and we're talking from 1789 all the way until 1935. So we have 146 years the Supreme Court was not allowed to have its own building because they wanted it under the watchful eye of the people. Now they've got their own building, and since they've got their own building, not under the watchful eye, man, have they gone wild. They're the policymakers. They do consider themselves to be the Supreme Court in everything. I mean, Everything goes to them.
Didn't they start off, I think you had said, in a closet?
Yes.
The founding fathers, in the original design, and in the first 9 years of the Supreme Court, they met in a closet in the Capitol building.
What year was the Supreme Court?
When they went into the U.S. Capitol building, it was from 1800. They moved in December of 1800, and from 1800 to 1809, the Supreme Court met in a closet outside the Senate. Then when the Senate moved to a larger room, the Supreme Court came out of the closet, and maybe that's not a good thing, maybe they ought to still, but they came out of the closet, they got the basement of the Senate building. Then when the Senate moved to where they are today, the Supreme Court came upstairs and got the old Senate building. And that's where they were until 1935 when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt built them a separate building and moved them out. And by the way, in 1935, the Supreme Court still only met for 6 weeks out of every year. Now they're up to 9 months out of every year. And the more they meet, the more they get into.
It's really taking a role that wasn't intended.
Never originally designed. I mean, the founders are clear. The people are in charge. Number one, God's in charge. God, they laid it out. God's in charge. Number two, under God, the people are in charge. And way down at the bottom of the list is judges. And that was the way they designed it.
Well, not unrelated to this point, you point out in here something that, as I speak about it, people are astonished. Our founders said explicitly and wrote that they were not establishing a democracy.
They hate democracy because
that means whatever the majority says goes, and that's the final word. They established instead a republic based on the rule of law, and they, as original intent outlines, acknowledged the two kinds of laws. There's divine law, there's human law,
that's right.
And no human law has any validity if it contradicts God's law.
That's exactly right.
Well, we thank you for putting this resource together, drawing from all these original documents and from the research you've done. We will continue to promote this. We look forward to continuing to collaborate with the work of wall builders. And thanks for everything.
Thanks, Father.
And thank you, Janet, as well. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for joining us at this look at original intent. There's so much more for all of us to learn about what our founding fathers had in mind when they established this great nation. Let's learn it. Go to wallbuilders.com. Be in touch with us at Gospel of Life, and let's impart to our children and to our children's children this beautiful vision of a land that is free and that finds its freedom in the Lord Jesus Christ. God bless you. My friends, welcome to our action segment. Janet, we've talked about a powerful book here, and I see the potential of this book to be that it corrects the terrible gap we have between what American history really represents, what our founders actually intended in starting this country, and what our children are learning in school. You were a teacher yourself. You know what's going on here.
That's right. You know, the things that David Barton told us, to me, it was like a refresher course for me for some of the things I learned. But that's not currently being taught in civic and American history classes. The original intent, as the book says, of our forefathers has gone, it's been disappeared, really. And what we'd like to say to our viewers is, if you like what you heard on this program, and you're saying to yourself, yeah, wow, that's what George Washington, that's what Ben Franklin meant, that's what this one meant. Well, we need you to spread that message, first of all, by getting the book.
Get the book,
because what you heard from David here was a fraction of what is in this book. And it's fabulous. It's called Original Intent. You can contact us at Gospel of Life. We'll make it available to you. And after you've read this book, then I think you're going to be on fire. You're going to say to yourself, well, I got to get other people to read this book.
Yes.
And here's where we need your help. Think about this. How many people do you know teach history in high schools or junior highs? You need to get this book in their hands because really, you know, most teachers, and I know this as a teacher, you're teaching out of the textbooks that the school is providing. Well, there's no reason why that teacher can't go off and have extra lessons weeded in. And when you put this in the hands of a good history teacher, you're going to be really opening their eyes about the content that they're not covering. So that's one aspect.
Let's dwell on that for a moment. People who have students in school.
Right.
There are parent-teacher conferences at some point during the year.
That's right.
What better way to say thank you to your child's history teacher than to bring them a gift?
That's right.
And bring them that, but put it in their hands. Tell them, I just thought you'd be interested in reading this. You don't have to go into a whole long philosophical or religious discussion or debate
no,
with
absolutely
them.
Absolutely not.
You just say, here's a gift. I thought you'd be interested in this. this book I found very interesting because it is one of the best summaries of the relationship between the courts, the Constitution, and religion.
Any good teacher, once they begin to read a couple of chapters in this book, it will draw them in, and they themselves will see the power of what they can do with their students with information like this.
In fact, if your own history teacher that you had in school is still teaching, what better thing to do than to go back and say thank you by giving them that book?
That's right. The other thing, too, is you can donate the book, buy it yourself, and donate it to your school library, because very often school libraries are more than happy to take a donation of a book. So, again, mm-hmm. that makes it available because, you know, a lot of students are in particular, you know, interested in one subject. So kids who are interested in history will be gravitated to any new title on history that a school gets.
And the public library, for that matter, as well.
That's right. I know for a fact I donated books that we purchased, pro-life books, to our libraries in New York, and public libraries gladly took the books.
It would be very good, too, for people who are involved in curriculum committees to be aware of this book and bring it to those that are on those committees, because if this can be incorporated formally into curricula in high schools and in colleges on history, and for that matter in law schools, then it's very important to put that into the hands of these people.
That's right, because, see, that's the whole problem, is that the curriculum has drifted so far away from what our founding fathers had intended that we kind of have to do a big job now of getting it to drift back where it belongs.
Giving this to law students, to law schools, and also to clergy, because we're talking here about the relationship between government and religion,
that's
state
right.
and church. This book is powerful for clergy to have. They can preach from it. They can learn from it themselves quite a bit.
That's right. You know, it's like you just said, the separation of church and state, that was not, the way it's quoted now, was not the intention of our founding fathers.
In fact, it's exactly the opposite of
That's
the intention
right.
of the founding fathers.
You know,
fathers.
Our whole government was founded on the fact that they were Bible-believing Christians, and they took the Bible as the source of all our founding documents and laws.
People can also use this book in a very powerful way to prepare letters to the editor.
That's
when you
right.
write letters to the editor, especially when we're in a time when there are such false notions about the separation of church and state, take some quotes from that book. Because when you're quoting our founding fathers themselves, you're not just expressing your opinion, you're expressing their teaching.
Now, and also you can look at times of the year. For example, on July 4th, that's a perfect time to send a letter to the editor. You know, talking about the Declaration of Independence, we're celebrating that. And again, take quotes from these books, you know.
Good. Thank you, Janet. And thank you, brothers and sisters, for joining us for this program. Continue to be in touch with us so that together we can build a culture of life.
I'm Dr. Paul Shank, Executive Director of Gospel of Life Ministries. Father Frank Pavone, Janet Moran, and I want to personally invite you to be a strategic part of this new, exciting, and challenging work. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." The objective of Gospel of Life Ministries is to reach out to Christians of all denominations and churches and bring them together in practical ways to proclaim the Gospel of Life and to build a culture of life. If you are a committed Christian, a pastor, Sunday school teacher, church leader, pro-life volunteer, if you have a burden to see believers cooperate together, we'd like to hear from you. To obtain our resources, contact us at Gospel of Life Ministries, P.O. Box 60038, Staten Island, New York, 10306. Call us at 718-980-4400 and visit us at www.gospeloflife.net.